You're listening to Gloria Minot Presents.
Plus, along with Ife Williams, we have some giants in the, let me put it, the ice cream world, right? We got Ben and Jerry's here. Let's just say
we're not skinny.
You're not skinny, right?
I don't know if we're giants.
and we're just very thankful that they've taken the time to be with us with WPFW. And they just made both of them a tremendous speech on stage, really talking about sort of the dynamics of race and racism and the whole issues around white privilege. So I want to thank you for making those comments. And why is it important for you to be here, and why is it important for you to represent today?
Well, we thought it was important for us to talk about what it would have been like if Jerry and I were black. And would we have been able to build the business that we built? And, you know, the conclusion was no, we wouldn't. That because of white privilege, you know, I mean, it was amazing to me when I started realizing, you know, how many African Americans are in jail for smoking pot. I mean, something which I did my share of and, you know, which I was actually stopped by the police for. And it's pretty clear. I mean, if I wasn't a middle-class white guy, I'd be in jail for it.
Well, you know, how interesting that you talk about many blacks being in jail for smoking pot. And yet we have someone in the White House who has admitted crimes, absolute crimes, and they're still there and supposedly leading our nation. But I wanted to ask you a question about black people. I know we eat a lot of ice cream. Do we eat a lot of your ice cream?
You know, I haven't been that closely involved with the company lately, what I seem to remember, during the days when I was still involved in it, black people were eating more Haagen-Dazs than they were Ben and Jerry's.
Oh, we got to change that.
And I don't know what the situation is now. Do you?
I don't either, you know, but it's kind of interesting to think about. I mean, Ben and Jerry's started in Vermont, which is a very white state, and the container has a picture of Ben and me, two white guys. And, you know, I don't know that we're perceived as a particularly white company, but, you know, Ben and Jerry's and Ben and Jerry are these white guys. And, you know, as Ben mentioned, part of what we were talking about for us is not only how black and brown people get screwed so much, but becoming aware of the privilege that we experienced when we were so oblivious about it when we were growing up. We just kind of thought we were living normal American lives, and this is what everybody goes through. And it turns out it's not what everybody goes through, that we experienced a tremendous amount of privilege that we just were not aware of. And I think that's true for so many white people.
Yeah.
And I got to ask, because I perceive Ben and Jerry's, obviously, as socially conscious as a company. And is concerned about things that are taking place in our society and seems to put yourselves forward in terms of addressing those kinds of issues, at least attempting to stand on the moral. Where does that come from? Because you talk about being oblivious on one hand.
Yeah.
So where would that come from? Because if you don't see, you don't move.
Yeah, you know, so the company's been around about 40 years. Initially, the push for those things came from Ben and also another close friend of ours, Jeff Furman, who really initiated the social mission at the company. But what's been amazing is that, as Ben mentioned, neither one of us is involved in the management or operating, yet the business has become even more outspoken. And so it's now baked into the company, and the CEO of Ben & Jerry's is really setting the tone for that.
So, somebody would say that those types of political issues shouldn't go hand in hand with business. That somehow it should be out there, and that business needs to be about business. Why is it important that there's a fusion between the two?
I think that business is the most powerful force in the society. Business controls our legislation through lobbyists. It controls our elections through campaign contributions. You know, if business doesn't take a stand on these issues, we're not going to be able to address them. We're not going to be able to succeed. And I also think that traditionally, I agree with you that it's been the general idea that business should not take a stand on political issues. But what we discovered at Ben & Jerry's is that you can do it and you can still sell your product. And I think that what we've learned, something that we didn't expect, was that it's helped to build the brand. I think when we take issues on things like Black Lives Matter, I think it helps sell ice cream. It's not why we're doing it, but I think, yeah, some people are against it. You know, I mean, some people write in to us and they say, oh, I'm never going to buy your stuff again. But on the other side, there's other people who want to buy it more.
You're listening to WPFW, and we've just been joined by Gloria Minot, and we're talking with Ben and Jerry. And I wanted to ask one question. You know, in the black community, we're always trying to find businesses to come into our community. Do you have franchises in your company?
Yeah, we do. And it's interesting that we were just talking with someone who works at our company this morning. Hey, Danny Glover just showed up.
Yes.
And we were talking about the idea that there aren't that many Ben & Jerry's scoop shops in black areas. And he was saying that, you know, we've got some kind of screen to try to select an area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it deals with income levels, or I don't know what it deals with, but that it has been screening out black areas. And so we're in the process of changing that.
Well, I'm president of the National Congress of Black Women, and our organization, when we celebrate women, we also celebrate good brothers. So I'd say you qualify for our good brother award. And we've been joined by another good brother, Danny Glover.
Danny
Hello.
Glover.
I'm here with Ben and Jerry, man.
The goodest good brother.
Okay. Well, it's wonderful that you're here with us, but then, of course, you've been here all along, so we're really proud of you and what you do. And I know that Dr. King were here, he'd be proud of what you do. It's up to us now to carry on with his dream, because we know that there are those who've been trying to take it away. So tell our audience.
Words up there.
Yes, I know our audience has been listening to you for years.
I've had a great opportunity to understand King's vision when he talked about the World House, that we're all inseparable. So whatever has connected to someplace else in the world is connected to us, and vice versa. And it's supposed to understand that, you know, the neoliberal paradigm began somewhere else, but it finds its home right here as a part of the Trump administration, the continuation. It continues around the rest of the world, and those countries that have opposed it most vigilantly are the countries that are often most targeted for regime change and etc., who oppose the paradigm. And it changed that. So there's a great deal, that part of the history of this country and part of the radical history of this country is this internationalism. You know, it was Paul Robeson and W.B. Du Bois They were that saw the foresaw the vision of the decolonization process. All these connections that are happening, that have happened historically around the world. And it was that radicalism that drives you. I'm from San Francisco, California.
Yes.
Okay. The stories we hear about Harry Bridges, socialist league unionists, organized local 10 of the ILWU, International Longshore Union, shut down the port. Shut down the ports all along the West Coast during the strike of 1934, 1935. Went around to all the black churches. There wasn't a Golden Gate Bridge. There wasn't a Bay Bridge. Went all the black churches and said, you don't cross the picket line. You don't become scabs on our strike. I promise you, black men will be on the docks when we win the strike. And the operative word was, we're going to win. Mm. And the rest of the deal. So I come up with a generation of men and women whose fathers, whose grandfathers, whose uncles, whose great uncles worked on the docks as longshoremen. They became part of the middle class. They were to buy homes when it was affordable in San Francisco. They formed communities in San Francisco. All of this is part of the history, but it's the radical notion of the possibilities. And Cat King was a radical. He was a liberation theologian. That's what he talked about. And we missed the point. We sit here and talk about the mall on August 28, 1963, and think about him. But he was beyond that, talking about the world. Then he did the war. He talked about the war. He talked about the war and connected racism, militarism, and extreme materialism. He's all of those. All of those, with his prophetic vision, he saw those becoming embodied in that. But that's part of this country's history, you know. He understood the role slavery played. There's many scholars now are talking about Blackman's book, Slavery by Another Name. Wall Street Journal, from Alabama, Slavery by Another Name. He documents, after Reconstruction, what happened from after Reconstruction all the way in every southern state, every single southern state, the re-enslavement of African Americans until just before World War II. All this important information that we have to understand. Because black men come to Alabama and say, I can't accept the myth that this is the way black people are. Something had to happen. Something happened to him. W. Du Bois, Black Reconstruction. Whew. He needs some research. Black Reconstruction. W. Du Bois deconstructs that the boys deconstructs, refutes the lies that are told about Reconstruction. Black legislators doing Reconstruction introduced public education, not only for blacks, but for poor whites. They introduced some of the most far-sighted. It was a real democracy in action. You got to kill that stuff. The populist movement, all the movements brought in poor whites and blacks together, they turned at the end of the 19th century. You got to understand that those movements had to be crushed. The radicalism of Eugene Debs, the radicalism of Emma Goldman, you got to run them out of the country. You got to crush those movements. And that's what has happened. So King was exemplary of those movements. He was a continuation of the movement. He knew that. He wasn't the greatest preacher. He knew that. He knew that the moment was right, this moment right here, where the movement was going to take a big step. And whatever step that is.
Absolutely.
Is the country trumpeting itself at the end of World War II, is the bastion of liberty and democracy after defeating fascism, and what is happening when black soldiers come back home? What is happening? All of that, he saw that. He was born into that and grew into that. And like anyone who understands, as a Marxist term, dialectic materialism, he understood the dialects of change. He understood the dialects of history, the dialectics of history. And he used that as a platform in everything, and understand, and pushing us forward. And he had young people pushing him. Those young people, student nonviolent, they were pushing him. The Democrat, you know, the Freedom Party, Democratic Freedom Party, were the first ones to come out and give support in Vietnam in 1964.
How about that?
Thank
yes.
you.
Absolutely.
When they tried to unseat the Mississippi Democratic Party.
Yes.
At the convention. The first one to come out. King got sentenced. People are talking about it.
For more information about Gloria Minot Presents, go to Gloria Minot Presents, one word,